That man is talking to his fellow astronaut while he walks in space.
Germany will take a free kick. You might expect to see the England defenders lining up what we call a wall.
That World Cup soccer match is being seen around the world through TV satellite by 500 million people.
Prendre à son tour l'initiative de proposer une réunion politique des six.
That great national leader, former wartime ally, is now competing with the United States for world leadership. Quartet of long-maned youngsters like those makes $2 million a year, while their native England totters near bankruptcy and struggles to keep her old foothold in this new world. Fantastic. A fantastic world, where the loser in a great war fattens in prosperity, while the winner struggles to survive. Where clothes, books, paintings, and plays are designed for novelty and shock. Where supersonics shrinks distance while medicine stretches life. Where the only thing permanent is dramatic and challenging change. This is Ben Grauer. A line of extraordinary human adventure runs through the story of this fantastic world, these fabulous years from the Depression to today. And I've had the opportunity through my broadcasting assignments to share much of it as an eyewitness. Never, it seems to me, in all the world's history, has so much been crammed into a bare third of a century. Yet we've all lived it or heard our parents talk about it. My task is to sort out, in the midst of all its contradictions and varying streams, some of the key events, the highlights of happenings that have brought us to where we are today. For that, we'll have to go back down the trail of the Cold War, back to 1962.
Unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
Through 1952.
And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away.
Back to the day when the Nazi guns fell silent in 45.
General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
Back to Pearl Harbor.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
And as we travel back in time, we realize through the interconnecting events that to really understand our era, we'll have to go through the years of Hitler's rise back to those violent economic convulsions which gave him and other leaders who fed on disorder their basic power. The prosperous and innocent 1920s ended in the crash of 1929 and a world depression. Brave voices in typically American style, popular favorites jested about our troubled world. Eddie Cantor.
Nowadays, when a man walks into a hotel and requests a room on the 19th floor, the clerk asks him for sleeping or jumping.
And Will Rogers.
We'll hold the distinction of being the only nation in the history of the world that ever went to the poorhouse in an automobile.
In that atmosphere of surface jokes and deep confusion, a whole order changed. It could be best signalized by the sweeping vote of 1932, which unseated the Republicans, brought in the Democrats, and raised to the national scene a voice and personality which was to dominate the era. At the bottom of the Depression, against a background of deepest confusion, his inaugural speech set the keynote for a return of confidence. Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And from that ringing phrase, the nation took heart. In his first 3 months, the 100 days, the basic New Deal legislation was enacted. The closed banks, the 12 million unemployed, the street corner apple sellers, and the Hooverville shantytowns gradually disappeared. Those were the days of the Alphabet Acts, the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, the NRA, National Recovery Act, AAA, Agriculture Adjustment Act. The doubters still were there, centering around the Republican leader and former president Herbert Hoover.
Planned industry and planned farming and planned credit and planned currency and planned attack upon the Constitution. I might suggest two more. There are planned deficits and planned politics.
And former Democrat and first sponsor of FDR, Al Smith.
Now, let me say this. Somebody is going to be double-crossed. Who is it going to be?
But the gross national product figures indicated the climb up out of the pit of depression had really begun. The WPA spent billions on public works and public art. And the Wagner Labor Act and the SEC made new deals for labor and for Wall Street. With any powerful new regime, new point of view, there are objectors. For a time, one of the most successful was the former governor of Louisiana, Senator Huey Long, the Kingfish, who had a soak the rich, share the wealth program, every man a king.
Mr. Roosevelt has had his way. He's one man that can't blame any of his troubles on Huey Long. He's had his way. Back down in my part of the country, if any man has the measles, he blames that on me. But there's one man that can't blame anything on anybody but himself, and that's Mr. Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
An assassin's bullet laid him low in his state capital, and his followers dwindled away. By the time the 1936 presidential elections came, I recall the Literary Digest poll run by one of the leading magazines of that day told us that Landon, the Republican candidate, would sweep the nation. But all he could garner was two states in the Northeast. Democratic National Chairman Jim Farley said sardonically, "As Maine goes, so goes Vermont." FDR sketched his second term.
One-third of a nation ill-nourished, ill-clad, ill-housed.
The 1936 election had given FDR the kind of resounding endorsement he needed for broader adventures. Now he could start thinking, not of the immediate present, but of the future of our land.
To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
A rendezvous with destiny, first foreshadowing by the president of the international involvements to come. Already there had been signs for those who were wise enough to read them. We can all see them plainly now from our elevation of years. The Japanese invaded Manchuria in 1931 and created a puppet state torn from Chinese hands. The new leader of Italy, a socialist journalist turned fascist, Il Duce, Benito Mussolini, marched into Ethiopia on a pretext in 1935. The courageous king, Haile Selassie, to this day one of the world's inspiring figures, defied him hopelessly. His appeals at Geneva went unanswered. The League of Nations was finished. When that happened, the destiny of the world was sealed. But we didn't really know. We didn't really know or understand the meaning of those bombs over African skies. As we listened at home, we did begin to recognize a new symbol of armed power. A dictator haranguing a crowd at home and by microphones to all the world.
Hanno ostacolato la marcia e spesso insidiato l'esistenza medesima del popolo italiano.
Italian style from a balcony, or German style, at a party congress, with all the settings of Wagnerian music and drama. We listen to Rudolf Hess.
Die Partei ist Hitler! Hitler aber ist Deutschland, wie Deutschland Hitler ist! Hitler, Sieg Heil! Hitler, Sieg
Heil! Sieg Heil, hail victory. At the very heart and core of this reborn Germany was Adolf Hitler, whose name was to become the incarnation of evil energy and power. He defied the Versailles Treaty and marched into the Rhineland in 1936, and England and France did nothing. Their leaders were paralyzed, transfixed, apparently just as the world's millions were as they listened to him.
Lebensausdruck unseres Volkes und damit ein Symbol des Ewigen. Es lebe die nationalsozialistische Bewegung. Es lebe Deutschland.
Amen.
The Nazi hymn, the Horst Wessel song, stirred forebodings on these shores. The gathering clouds were noted by our president in a key speech in 1937. The Quarantine the Aggressor speech.
And mark this well. When an epidemic of physical disease starts to spread, the community approves and joins in a quarantine of the patients in order to protect the health of the community against the spread of the disease.
While fascism had been building abroad, what had been the memorable events that marked our life at home? Well, a new period began with the end of Prohibition, a creation of well-meaning and devoted reformers that had done precisely the opposite of what they'd aimed for. Since liquor was forbidden, it went into illegal and highly profitable channels. The whole era of the gangster and the hijack, the one-way ride and the rule of the underground took over. The jazz age had led to the speakeasy age, and the only thing that ended that was the end of the Prohibition dream, repealed in 1933. The post-repeal 30s, a time of glamour and sex in the movies with Gene Harlow and Mae West. Talkies and technicolor, marathon dances and miniature golf. A changing society that was summed up in a tune of the day that became a pop standard. Sung here by the original crooner, Rudy Vallee.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't take it serious, it's too mysterious. You work, you save your worry, so, but you can't take your dough and your go, go, go.
A flamboyant personality as mayor of New York, Fiorello LaGuardia, the little flower. He named the first great airport of the new air age after himself. Years later, during a newspaper strike in New York City, he was to dash to his municipal station microphone one Sunday morning to read the comics to the kids.
And the picture shows a hand of breathless, stretching out. She's got hold of that iron pot. Remember the iron pot she took from the Van Hoosen's gardener's flat to put the money in? And crash! She crashes it on his head. Knocked out. Next picture we see Dick Tracy. You know the fine type of Dick Tracy? He's been a detective so long, and he still has that slender form. Lou Valentine, why do our detectives get fat, I wonder? Well, anyhow, here's Tracy.
America's air hero, Lucky Lindy, became a tragic figure with the kidnapping of his baby boy in 1932. I searched without success for a recording of our reports from State Police Headquarters in Trenton that March night, when I broadcast the baby's formula for use by the kidnappers, not knowing it lay in a scooped-out grave a few miles from us. The trial of kidnapper Hauptmann was a high event of our mid-30s. And there was miniature golf and marathon dances and the end of the lighter-than-air age as the world's biggest dirigible, the Hindenburg, came into a landing, an event immortalized in this unique eyewitness description of Herbert Morrison's. You can hear the distant thud of the first explosion seconds before his startled senses are able to report it.
The van had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from bursting into flames.
Get it started. It's crashing. Terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast. And all the folks between us, this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and it's flames now. And the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the fans.
Just as in the 20s, the dominating sports figures had been Jack Dempsey and Babe Ruth, in the 30s it was a big, slow-talking young Negro from Georgia, Joe Louis. He won his world's heavyweight title from Jim Braddock in 1937, but he felt he had to erase an earlier defeat at the hands of the former champion, the German Max Schmeling, by a rematch. The biggest sports audience ever listened that night. Before the fight, they heard former champion Jack Dempsey.
Well, it's anybody's fight, but I favor Max Mulling because I saw Joe Louis work out, and he looks to me like everybody's hitting him.
And Gene Tunney.
I believe that if Louis gets the jump in the beginning of the fight, he'll win. But if he's going to allow himself to maneuver around by Schmeling, I believe that Schmeling is going to win.
And Max Baer.
Well, I'm stringing along with Louis this time, although in the last fight, I selected Schmeling. As a matter of fact, I want him to win, because I want to be the first fighter to regain the heavyweight championship.
And Der Max himself.
I'm feeling comfortable and in good shape. My walk here at the training camp has put me in the best of condition.
Held to his feet, held to the rope, look to his corner, in helplessness, and Schmeling is down. Schmeling is down.
Handling the blow-by-blow, the sports commentator whose jaunty manner and bug-eyed voice was evocative of the era, Clem McCarthy.
And Donovan is watching carefully. Louis measured him. Right to the body, a left up to the jaw, and Schmeling is down. The count is 5, 5, 6, 7, 8. The men are in the ring. The fight is over on a technical knockout. Max Schmeling is beaten in one round.
A German pugilist lying in defeat on the ring floor was only a goad to the German leader Hitler at home. The war clouds, which had been gathering since 1934 and the remilitarization of Germany, were now preoccupying the chancelleries of the world. In the midst of this came an extraordinary event, important enough for its political impact, but at the same time having unique, universal meaning. The new King of England, Edward VIII, had fallen in love with a divorced commoner, an American woman named Wallace Warfield Simpson, Wally. Royal tradition and Commonwealth considerations could not accept her as queen. The human drama was climaxed by the abdication speech of the man whom the world had known as the carefree and gallant Prince of Wales. That speech had the largest audience around the world via radio.
You must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love. And now we all have a new king. I wish him and you, his people, happiness and prosperity with all my heart. God bless you all. God save the king.
The power of the human voice speaking into the home had been realized years before by Hitler. With it, he had welded a unified Germany through his disciplines and his demagoguery. Now it was to be a major tool to work his blackmail on the West. Give me Czechoslovakia, he ranted, or I march.
Ich bin Mr. Chamberlain dankbar für all die Bemühungen. Ich habe ihm versichert, dass das deutsche Volk nichts anderes will als Frieden.
Making a pilgrimage with palsied hands to Gottesberg, to Berchtesgaden, was the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. The crisis came at the meeting arranged by Mussolini with Hitler at Munich. England and France yielded the Sudetenland Germans and thus Czechoslovakia to Hitler. The next morning, Chamberlain brandished a piece of paper at London Airport.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
Some prophetic and some wise who saw beyond those hollow cheers, who dared to foresee the future and talk about it, they warned of the danger, with accent on the new import of the word, the danger of appeasement, especially since Hitler had seized Austria by Anschluss. Now there emerged from the British Parliament onto the international scene a personality who, giant-sized and inspiring in his dimension and his humanity, was to be heard as the conscience of free men for the next decade. Winston Churchill, with the unique quality of heaven-soaring power of insight and the common touch.
I fear greatly the storm will not pass. It will rage and it will roar ever more loudly, ever more widely. It will spread to the south. It will spread to the north.
Hitler's maneuvers to grab territory were seen in complete clarity by a speaker who, if he had been heeded, would have changed the destiny of the world. The son of the founder of Czechoslovakia, the nation now crushed by Hitler, spoke from London, Jan Masaryk.
Let me be perfectly frank. I believe I have the right to be so. If Hitler attempts another bloodless victory for vulgar gangsterism and the world, including the United States of America, let him get away with it. I have no illusions about the future of the European civilization. And what's more, we all deserve what is coming to us.
Like the Sudeten question in Munich, the crisis over Danzig was a Hitler device to mask his long-planned attack, this time on Poland. But this was the big package. Americans on that Labor Day weekend in 1939, sitting at their radios, found themselves ringside at the beginning of a new world war. First, the bombshell news of a Hitler pact with Russia. Then they heard the German Führer in the Reichstag. The broadcast from overseas punctuated with bulletins from Bob Trout in New York.
Wenn Polen versuchen sollte, auf dem Weg zollpolitischer Maßnahmen Danzig wirtschaftlich zu vernichten, dass dann Deutschland nicht mehr länger untätig zusehen könnte.
I told the Polish ambassador 3 weeks ago that if situation continued as it was, if Danzig were persecuted and were attempted by Poland to ruin Danzig economically, the situation could not be tolerated.
We interrupt this broadcast of Adolf Hitler's speech just momentarily to report a dispatch from Paris which says that Premier Daladier of France has now called the French Council of Ministers for an emergency meeting which is to take place just 10 minutes from now at 5:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
Ich habe mich daher nun entschlossen, mit Polen in der gleichen Sprache zu reden, mit der Polen und seit Polen.
I therefore resolved to speak to Poland in the same language in which Poland has addressed us for such a long time.
Es war nur eine Frage, die geklärt werden musste.
Once again, we interrupt very briefly this talk by Chancellor Hitler to announce that in London, Parliament has been summoned to meet at 6 p.m. in London, which is 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time today.
Nicht nach Deutschland zu exportieren gedenkt. Im selben Augenblick sehe ich keine Veranlassung mehr, dass wir auch nur einmal gegeneinander Stellung nehmen sollen.
I see no reason, says Mr. Hitler, why Russia and Germany should have been enemies any longer.
Polen hat heute Nacht zum ersten Mal auf unserem eigenen Territorium auch mit bereits regulären Soldaten geschossen. Und von jetzt ab wird Bombe mit Bombe vergolten.
From now on, bomb will be met by bomb.
British Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note, stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
And finally, the American president.
This nation will remain a neutral nation, but I cannot ask that every American remain neutral in thought as well. Even a neutral has a right to take account of facts. Even a neutral cannot be asked to close his mind or close his conscience.
Victory! Victory!
That's the way World War II began. We heard it, like that, at our homes. And then we went about our business, and the war seemed to slide into some sort of phony stalemate. The only thing that reminded us of it was the occasional voluntary appeal, like Bundles for Britain, and the heart-touching broadcast to home of little British children who had been evacuated by their apprehensive parents to America. Playing through some of those tapes, I recognized my own voice in this exchange.
Hello, Mom.
Hello, darling. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you? I hope you're having a merry Christmas.
Listen, Violet.
Yes.
Come on, now, don't be silly now.
Just a moment. Mrs. Dollop, just a moment. We'll have Violet for you in just a minute. Here's Ronnie who wants to add a word, and then we'll come back to Violet.
Hi, Mom. Hello, Sal. How are you? I'm going to cry.
The phony war, stalemate throughout the winter and spring on the Maginot Line. And then on May 10th, 1940, Blitzkrieg, lightning war, the German invention which changed the history of military tactics. The Dutch surrendered on the 15th, the Belgians on the 28th. The French were routed. The British Expeditionary Force was trapped at the Channel port of Dunkirk. 300,000 troops were delivered to safety by a weird flotilla of 800 jury-rigged pleasure craft. The British turned to the only man they hoped could save them. Chamberlain was dropped as Prime Minister. Churchill took the reins.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. Behind us, behind the armies and fleets of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned races, the Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch, the Belgians, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless we conquer, as conquer we must, as conquer we shall.
With the Panzers rolling over helpless France, Mussolini declared war on her on June 10th, an act promptly described by FDR as a stab in the back. The Germans stood at the gates of the French capital, and we heard Premier Paul Reynaud, and then a final defiant mass singing of the Marseillaise from the Paris radio.
Comprenez donc!
Mr. Reynaud is saying, let all who are watching this drama of the Battle of France understand therefore, and let them understand at once. For the stakes are enormous, and only time can truly measure them. As for us, more than ever before, we have confidence in our arms.